Hi there, this is Michael Kollo, the Curious Quant, and today it is my absolute pleasure to be speaking with Professor Campbell Harvey, who's an absolute giant in the field of finance, and specifically coming from the academic side. He's published over 125 articles on all kinds of topics, from investor skill to factors to even things in blockchain. And today I'm really going to be speaking to Cam about the notion of statistical evidence, so how you think about what is a real or not real signal. He recently published a really interesting paper detailing 400 factors that have been published in academic journals since the 1970s, and that most of these are possibly don't find support or the statistical validation is fairly weak. But we're also going to be talking about factor investing and what different kinds of factors mean, which ones pertain to long term, which one pertains to short term, how you think about that in light of alternative data, and also how you think about evidence for these factors, especially in light of methodologies like machine learning that is entering our industry. So I hope you can join us. This is a truly exceptional conversation. Hi, everybody. This is Michael Kollo, the Curious Quant, and I have the great, great pleasure today of being joined by Professor Campbell Harvey. Welcome, Professor.
It's great to be on the show.
All right. So fantastic to have you with us. And I think, you know, you've got an incredible wealth of experience and obviously background in finance. I'm sure most of our listeners would have heard of you or read some of your papers. I mean, I think I saw recently at 125 scholarly articles attributed to you, which is just, you know, for somebody who's kind of, you know, labored through a couple of papers and kind of getting them out is just an incredible feat. But I'd love to maybe start off a little bit. I mean, this is something that we do often with the guests, is to hear a little bit about how you've come to be here through your career. So kind of where you started and how you made your way to where you are now.
Well, I never thought, like early in my career, whether it was or career, just my education, was the first person in my family to get an undergrad degree. And then I went to get a master's degree. And then I got a summer job during my master's that I hit on an idea. And the summer job was at a mining company in Toronto. I'm Canadian, by the way. And this company was heavily into copper, and we know that copper moves with the business cycle, and they were looking for a way to have some idea of what was going to happen next in the business cycle, because if they had a better forecast, and we know that copper moves very strongly with GDP growth, that better forecast could help them in terms of their mine closings, openings, the amount of production that they're actually doing. And I was tasked as a master's student to come up with a model. And I looked at two things. Number one, I looked at information in financial assets, and I started with the stock market, which a person, Eugene Fama at the University of Chicago, had done a lot of work on. But I found that that was really noisy because stock market's all over the place and it could crash, but it didn't really have much information about recessions. And then I hit on this idea of using bonds, in particular using the yield curve. So the information in the difference between a long-term interest rate and a short-term interest rate to extract information about future economic growth. So this is, again, I'm a first-year master's student. I go back for second year. I present this idea that I was working on for this company, and people were really excited about it. And they said, you need to apply for a PhD. And I had no idea. Again, I thought I was going to get the master's degree, get a regular job, maybe at this mining firm. And they said, no. You've got three required courses. We're going to collapse them into one, and you're going to write a paper. And they made things happen for me. They encouraged me to apply for doctoral studies. I ended up going to the University of Chicago. Looking back, on my application. It was probably, in hindsight, a strong application because I showed that I was interested in doing research. I attached the paper that I wrote at York University in Toronto, and I was accepted, and that turned out to be my dissertation, Inverted Yield Curves Predict Recessions.
In fact, I recently read a wonderful title. I'm not sure how happy you are, of course, about this, but it says, you are the godfather of the yield curve indicator. I'm not sure.
Yeah, so I've been called the godfather, which is kind of negative connotation, but father. I've been called the OG yield curve whisperer. That's maybe my most famous one. It's very interesting that today, I get the recognition, but in July 2006, before the global financial crisis, there was little or no recognition, even though the yield curve had successfully predicted six of the last six recessions. I'd recently got an interesting email from an academic colleague, but in 2006, he was an economist at the Fed. And he told me the story about him going in every week to Tim Geithner and basically making the case that the yield curve's inverted, that's bad news, the Fed should do something about that, or the Treasury even. And the Fed decided to hold the interest rate at 5.25% for 13 months of yield curve inversion until they had to take drastic action. And we know what happened with the global financial crisis. The rate went from 5.25% eventually to something close to zero. So even in 2006, this was completely ignored. Today, obviously, it's in the news. I guess maybe it has to be, given that it's predicted seven of the last seven recessions.
But I think what I find incredible, obviously, is that you've written 125 scholarly articles.
Well, it's not just that.
And yet, there's only one thing you get called on.
You think about how many of those would you trade for like a really, you know, seminal paper. So I don't look very much at the quantity. I'm looking for big ideas,
sure.
And those big ideas are really hard to find.
Well, let me actually hit you on the whole idea of quality and quantity, and you know, we can kind of return to some of these subjects a little bit recently, because I want to pick that up a little bit. So you've written an interesting paper recently with a co-author called A Census of the Factor Zoo, and we talked about this a little bit when you were visiting here in Sydney. But essentially, it's a paper, my understanding is, kind of detailing or documenting all of the different factors that have been identified by the financial literature over from 1972, I'd like to say, something like that. And basically, so like 400 factors, is that right? Is that about right?
Yeah, exactly. And let me tell you the genesis of that project. So I was the editor of the Journal of Finance for 6 years, and effectively seven, because you have so many papers you're dealing with even after you retire. So I was getting back to my research, and I was sitting with a couple of PhD students at Duke University. I said, well, I've dealt with 7,000 papers, and I've noticed that a lot of these papers are proposing a variable to explain the cross-section of asset returns. So the idea is that if you've got a high sensitivity to a particular factor, you should have a higher expected return if that's a risk factor. Low sensitivity, meaning a low expected return. So you're trying to explain the cross-section of expected returns. So I had the list of the 7,000, and I gave the list to the students, and I said, well, let's do a simple search for the following phrase, and the cross-section of expected returns, because that kind of stuck in my mind in that I thought, a number of these papers had this. And the goal of this was to catalog everything that was tried. So to create a census. And my idea was not to publish that paper, but just to put it online so it would help other researchers. So instead of citing, many, many different papers, you could just say, well, we looked at Campbell Harvey's paper and we refer you to that for a list of all of these things that were tried. So I set the students going on that. And I remember expecting that there'd be maybe 30 papers, something like that. This was not a big project. And my student came back, Yan Liu, who's at Purdue University right now, and he said, well, the initial screen, we got 130. I said, what? That's like 100 more than I expected. And that was just for a particular phrasing that we didn't even dig further, like omitting one word or two words. And we just sat there and realized that there's a really big problem with finance research in general. And let me explain what that problem is. Usually what we do in quantitative finance is we look for an effect or a factor or something like that that is significant statistically. And the usual rule that we use is 95% confidence, which is 2 standard deviations. That's the usual thing. Is it 2 standard deviations away from 0? Yes, then it's significant. However, and this is a very important however, that only applies to a single test. So if you're trying many things, then the 2 standard deviations will lead to many false positives. So for example, now I've got lots of examples on this, but if you're trying 20 different factors and 1 appeared to work and 19 didn't, well, that's just no big deal. That's exactly what you would expect, purely by luck. So it's nothing to do with the factor being true, that you would get that purely by luck. And it's not just factors. If you think of asset managers, suppose you've got an asset manager that outperforms a benchmark 10 years in a row. And you say, well, that manager must be skilled. Well, if you had 1,000 managers and none of them were skilled. They were just flipping coins. So heads, I overweight the market. Tails, I underweight the market. So if you had 1,000 managers with no skill whatsoever, then you expect one of those managers purely by luck, to outperform the benchmark 10 years in a row. And if you have 10,000 managers, 10 of them will beat the benchmark 10 years in a row, consecutive years. So basically the idea here is that you need to allow for the fact that there's a lot of things that have been tried. And with these factors, I document with Yan that, this is also important, the ones that showed up as publications in the top journals, that's 400. And we're really counting a handful of top journals. There's 95 journals in academic finance, and most of them I've actually never even heard of. So we didn't even go there. And indeed, there are many things that have been tried that didn't even make it to publication. So this idea of declaring a factor to be a real factor with a 2 standard deviation level of significance is just false. So I made a statement at a conference in 2015 that wasn't that popular at the time. I said that this problem wasn't just about factor research. This was about empirical research, empirical quantitative research in finance. I said that it's likely that over half of all of the empirical findings published in quantitative finance are false. And of course, that didn't go over too well with the crowd. There were obviously no applause for that one.
I can imagine.
Yeah, no, it's true. And my colleagues are saying, well, you know, it can't be right. You know, he's just grandstanding. And then a couple of years later, well, Harvey maybe had a point. And then today, the reaction is, oh, well, yes, I remember what Cam Harvey said in 2015 in that paper he published in January 2016, but it's no big deal. We already knew that.
Yeah.
So a much different sort of reception. So we've finally come around to realizing that you need to take test multiplicity, that's the technical way to say it, into account in what we do in finance. Other fields are way ahead of finance. And it's particularly a problem in academic finance. And I believe it's less of a problem in the practice of finance. And I can go into some more detail on that if you're interested.
Well, but I think it's a really good point. And before we kind of get there, I would certainly agree with this notion of kind of model selection. So as you say, you've got 1,000 models or managers, let's say. And I think the problem is actually worse than what you talk about, because let's say the top 10 have that 10-year return stream, which is above zero or kind of, you know, decent. But of those top 10, they also write books, and there's a lot of self-grandization, and there's a lot of self-attribution that happens as they go on CNBC and Bloomberg, and their stories become the narratives of the markets, and people go, yeah, that person's great. Because of that, this whole notion of kind of attribution to that. And so I used to tell my students when I was teaching in Imperial that when you go to the kind of finance library and you see the array of books written by people who have made a lot of money or invested or are famous in some way, you know, there's a fair amount of luck that goes into that. And then obviously people that are lucky write books about their secret formula to success, so to speak. But the ones who are not lucky don't. And so you don't really have the full distribution.
Yeah,
very select sample.
It's a classic, what we call in statistics, a selection problem.
Completely.
So yeah, the select number of people write those books because maybe they're skilled, maybe they're just pure lucky, or maybe it's a combination of skill and luck.
Sure.
So you need to be pretty careful. And I'm always very suspicious of these books that reveal the secret formula, because if the formula is any good, you never would want to publish it.
No, completely. And I think the other thing is quite interesting. So we had an early guest who's John Fass, from CEO of Quantopian, and he was kind of mentioning that they have 250,000 contributors on their website who essentially write code with data and create investment signals. And of course, you kind of, you know, they called it the swarm. And then, of course, you kind of think to yourself, well, that can't be 250,000 independent thoughts that people are kind of writing. Those are very unlikely to be. But I guess in the same kind of way, when you think about these 400 factors, if we were to do a PCA analysis on that, and we would say, well, how many of them are kind of the same thing, slightly different proxies for the same type of effect, or near enough, I suppose. I'm guessing
You'd be really surprised, because I've actually done that.
Ooh.
So these factors are a remarkably low correlation. They're long short portfolios, and when we calibrated in our 2016 paper in the Review of Financial Studies, we calibrated different levels of correlation, and we pushed it to like 0.2, but the actual correlation is much lower. And of course, what I'm not including here is if you've got 100 different definitions of momentum, obviously they're all going to be correlated. That's not what we did. We took one definition, the most popular definition, and used that. But you look at the actual correlation amongst the factors, it's there, but it's not as high as you think.
Well, that's an interesting point, because I guess that kind of leverages the conversation to saying either they are amazing sources of independent alpha, or they're noise. Because the other thing that has no correlation with each other is noise.
So there's many different ways to look at this. So you find an effect. So it looks like a significant trading strategy. It might be not true because it was just purely data mined and overfed. So that's a possibility. It might actually be true, But then once you start to trade it, very quickly it goes away because it was some sort of imperfection or anomaly in the market that's quickly arbitraged away. So it was real, but it doesn't work on a sample. It's possible that you found a long-term source of risk that's real, and then it doesn't work because the trade gets crowded. So that's a little different than the sort of arbitrage argument, is that the people start buying it, the price goes up, you expect a return goes down or negative. So there's many different reasons that something that you find doesn't actually work.
Yeah, and I think it's, as you say, it's there's an interesting feedback effect as well in some of these papers. As we know, when certain signals are published, their subsequent returns fall dramatically, usually if they are, let's say, genuine alpha. So there's a kind of the market is paying attention. But I'm just wondering, so in your mind, thinking of academic finance as a kind of industry, so where does that leave this industry? So if the observation is that so much of the research in a particular area, let's say, has been focused on finding results, and therefore because there's a focus on finding results rather than disproving other results, or rather just maybe even publishing papers where there's a very compelling theoretical model that's tested and found to have no empirical evidence, for example, which I'd love to see more of those papers, but I don't see enough of those. I suppose, you know, where does that leave this industry? Because it still feels to me like, you know, the publish or perish imperative is there. So people have to find ideas, and then they have to find seemingly theoretical and empirical basis for those ideas and then publish them. So that's just going to continue to build that pressure to use whatever means possible to find statistical validation?
Yeah, so it's a great question, and kind of links to something I mentioned a little later on. So this idea of publication for academics is very important. So to get published in a top journal, you need to have a good idea, and it's almost always the case that the result is significant. So journal editors are not too enthusiastic about publishing results that are not significant, because those papers don't get cited by others, and it doesn't really help advance the journal's profile. So these editors are in a competition, and their metrics are often based upon the number of times that the articles that they publish are cited by others. So they want papers with positive results, with results that are statistically significant, because they know if they publish the other papers that are not statistically as significant, then their journal is not going to advance in terms of the academic competition. So given that, the authors realize, well, for me to have a shot at a top journal, I need to have a significant result. And on top of that, and this is also important, at most schools, probably 90% of the schools around the world, a single publication, just one publication in one of the top three journals in finance leads to a job for life.
That's right.
So yeah. Tenure. Okay, so think of those incentives. So what essentially happens is a massive data mining exercise takes place, where many things are tried until you hit something that works within the sample. You spin a story around it, you submit it to the journal, it's strongly significant, it gets published, and it might be many years later found not to hold up out of sample, but many years later you got tenure. So you're already done. The tenure clock is 7 to 10 years. So the out of sample, that's not going to happen for a time after you actually published. So you've got academically the incentives to publish at whatever cost. And it's not like you're falsifying the data or fabricating. The result is a true result, except it's basically a data mined result. And this is basically what we face. So the incentives in academic finance are to publish. In the practice of finance, it's different. So in the practice of finance, and it's very unfortunate that what happens is that some bank will just grab the academic publication and wrap it around some ETF product, and in the sales pitch say, well, this was published in the Journal of Financial Economics, so it therefore it must be true. And that's just like really misleading, and especially given that 400 of these so-called strategies have been published in academic finance. And what happens? Investors buy that stuff and are disappointed. The actual research that's done within a private firm, let's say an asset manager, has got different incentives. So if you're doing independent research at a company, let's say a large asset manager, there is a significant downside to selling something to your client that turns out not to work. So the downside is that you lose that client, the client will redeem, and on top of that, and maybe even more important, your reputation takes a hit. So within the practice of investment management, the incentives are much more tightly aligned to what's good for the investment manager is also good for the client. You get a fee that is often related to the performance, whether it's direct or indirect. The direct fee would be like a hedge fund, 2 and 20 sort of thing, or 1 and 10. But the indirect is that you get assets that flow in to your fund if you do well. So you want to put the best possible product there. So the incentives are different. And I think that very few actually recognize this, and it's caused, I think, a skew in the research.
And that's a really interesting point, and I'm going to come back to that in a minute in terms of what the private sector feels like. But in terms of the ETFization or kind of rolling into product, so the academic research, I suppose one of the things that we've seen more recently is the whole started with spot beta minvol, and then it kind of progressed onto multiple factors. I mean, these are kind of the classic factors, right? So momentum, value, yeah, quality, etc. But obviously, as the race heats up for alternate risk premium or underneath that category, you start to see alternate data coming in. You start to see various different types of ideas, sentiment indicators, etc., coming into that space. And being still sold underneath the umbrella of a risk premium, harvesting risk premium, how many conferences I've been through where that terminology is used, as if these things were like rules of nature and they were kind of like the weather patterns. They were steady and stable. They were there forever, as opposed to being based themselves on academic work that suffers potentially from some similar problems, as you pointed out.
Yeah, so we need to be really careful. This is what I usually say. You talked about a kind of a base group of factors. We've been at this for a long time. So we've been at this since the 1960s. Data mining, essentially the same data sets, the stock returns, right? So everybody's looking essentially at the same historical data. And what I usually say is the following. The low-hanging fruit has already been picked. So given that's the case, if you find something new and exciting, I'm very skeptical. Okay, so the bar for me for a new sort of risk premia that's discovered is really high, because I know that there are thousands of people out there that are just data mining and trying to find something that works. So you need to be very careful about this. I've got no problem with smart beta products that are based upon risk premia that we've known and have been tested for a long time, good out-of-sample records. I have no problem with that whatsoever. I do have a problem with these ETFs being wrapped around some academic paper published in 2015 that finds something that is back-test overfit, and then you wrap a product around it that almost surely will disappoint the investors.
And I think that that's a an interesting point. I 100% agree with you. And I think the only kind of, not caveat, but conditionality I would add to that is that obviously a lot of the new data sets that are coming online are raising very interesting questions around the world in various quant shops saying, can we accept a signal or an idea that has 3 or 5 years of backtest performance or any kind of existence because we don't have any historic data. So I think there's an interesting area where they're not claiming they have found a new factor that used to work in the 80s and 90s, if only we knew about it back then, and now let's get it on, which I completely agree with you, has been, you know, mined not just by people and thousands of people, but by thousands of algorithms. So in that sense, you know, there's no elephants in that data. It's been sifted over and over again. It's like fine sand on a beach. I suppose the question is, you know, in the last 5 years, if we have a new data set, can we claim to have found something that is reliable, that is a source of, you know, continued alpha?
Yeah, okay, let's be careful here. So there are two kind of types of what I loosely call factors. So a factor to me is a source of a risk premia that is expected to persist in the long term. So, for example, you invest in equity, you expect equity to have a higher expected return than treasury bills. If you invest in illiquid securities, people don't like illiquidity. And that means that the prices are lower and the expected returns are higher. And that's something that's not going to go away. If you invest in assets that have negative skew or big downside risks compared to upside risks, well, nobody likes those. So prices are lower and expected returns are higher. These are things that are risk premia that you expect to happen over the very long term. There are other so-called alpha sources that are purely trading strategies. You find something, you find some information that's not incorporated in the market quickly. You're able to design a strategy, and it might be based on big data. I have no problem with some strategies that have limited amount of data, 3 years of text data or something like that. But those are the sort of things that once people kind of figure it out, they use the algorithm to process that information faster, those are the sort of alphas that will fade and potentially fade very quickly. So we need to draw the distinction between the set of factors that are expected to have a long-term risk premia and the set of trading strategies or anomalies or mispricings that have a shorter runway.
But I think that's a great way to distinguish them. So I completely agree. But going back to the first part, I think, you know, that argument certainly is predicated on this idea of the mismatch between demand and supply, I suppose, of an asset or the prices, right? So this notion that a very small part of the market, relatively speaking to the whole market, is able to take on, let's say, liquidity risk or certain types of skew or various things like that, or they don't have a preference to do so because of their risk characteristics. And I think certainly there's certain periods where that's true. And then there's other periods, I guess, where sort of macroeconomic forces or the aggregate climate changes, for example, now where we have zero interest rates and a whole bunch of large institutional investors who have hard return targets are having to move into these assets en masse that they normally, if they had other options, they wouldn't be moving into, but essentially are kind of forced into it by some kind of a big aggregate type dislocation. So I can certainly see, you know, in the so-called, fair distribution of all assets and liquidities in the market, that argument's sort of holding. I think there's certain periods, and maybe those periods can be quite extended, where that kind of mismatch of investor types could be moving into there, in which case I struggle with this notion that illiquidity always has to have an additional return, for example.
So you've mentioned at least four different things. So let me deal with some of them. First, I totally agree with you that the premia vary over time. And the first substantial paper I did was with Wayne Ferson at the University of Southern California, and it was called The Variation of Economic Risk Premia. And that was published a long time ago in 1991, where we made the economic case that these risk premia change through time. And it's kind of obvious, just think of the market itself, that in the depths of a recession, it's really hard to get people to give up cash and to invest in equity. So the price needs to be cheap, the expected return needs to be very high. And at the peak of good times, where it's plenty of money to go around, those prices are bid up and the expected returns are low. So it is a basic insight, and if I was writing that paper today, it would have been called a different title. It wouldn't have been called The Variation of Economic Risk Premiums. It would have been called Factor Timing.
Yes,
so,
of course, yeah.
So number one, I agree with you that the premia for these types of risks vary over the business cycle, and they also vary depending upon economic conditions. And what you've said is also a good point, that when rates are really low, some people are forced, and in my opinion, incorrectly, to reach for yield. And that could bid up the price of these risky assets, reducing the premia. So whether it's credit risk, whether it's illiquidity risk, the premium decreases. As to whether it goes away, I doubt it, especially for illiquidity. I seriously doubt it for negative skew, because indeed option prices are positive. So I think that's pretty clear that one is not going to reverse, but there could be significant variation through time. There are people, if you've got a long investment horizon, I've got a recent work in progress on matching risk with investment horizon. So some people have longer horizons than others, and that creates some opportunities. So the person with a very long investment horizon, they will just gobble up the illiquid assets. Indeed, they will wait for the opportunity to gobble them up. There's a reason that Warren Buffett is sitting on $150 billion of cash. He's just waiting for the recession. And we know from his history that he is the first one at any fire sale. And he made a boatload of money in the global financial crisis, essentially, quote unquote, bailing out. It didn't seem like bailing out to me. He was just getting a great deal on these assets. So this is a person that buys illiquidity. He also is long negative skew. So he's a major writer of out of the money S&P put options, long dated.
Yeah.
So that's got a huge negative tail, but no, you'll take the premium. So again, a lot of this depends upon the horizon, and you're correct that it's really the mix of people that really count. And for certain investors that have long horizons, and I wish that our pension plans had these longer horizons. Buffett is the guy that makes it happen with the longer horizon, even though he's got shareholders. But you've got these pensions that seemingly have a long horizon, but they certainly don't act like it. They should be long illiquidity. They should be welcoming a negative skew, because they can ride out a global financial crisis. So, and of course, they sacrifice returns for doing that.
I completely agree with you. And I think it's almost like I want to take your previous definition, which defined these type of sort of premium factors versus sort of alpha insight signals, mispricing, et cetera, and maybe add another category or two to slice the first one into what I would term as more statistical quantitative kind of signals, so value momentum, which are kind of tested and created and sculpted in a very, very specific way, which have this kind of a profile that they have a gradual, steady as she goes returns. Like it's you're clipping your coupon. You know, we've both seen the kind of incredible IR or sharp lines that kind of go upwards. Whether we believe it or not, that a lot of these things are kind of sculpted in that, you know, steady as she goes way, and the optimizers that are trying to maximize sharp or IR versus the kind of premia that you just outlined for example, long-term investors, which are essentially event-based premia in some sense, that, you know, you do nothing for 9 years and then the recession comes and then you're fully in. And then essentially Your horizon when you go into that fire sale is really a function as to how, you know, shallow or deep that V is, or when prices recover. So it's kind of endogenous. But essentially, you only take action at specific events or at specific opportunities, which are very infrequent, which means you don't have that steady as she goes gradual kind of premium that you can harvest.
Well, I would add to this that you can be active in terms of some of these strategies. So it is common to write some options. So, and you collect your annual return based upon that. You get the premia as long as the negative event doesn't happen. So that you need to be really careful with, because that's just taking risk. So I was once contacted by a former student that wanted me to be on like an advisory board for his fund, and done really well. It was close to $1 billion. Had a great 9-year track record of beating the S&P almost every year. And I said, "Well, what is the strategy?" And the student said, "Well, we just roll the S&P 500 futures and write some out of the money options, and that's how we get our 2% performance every year." So I said to the student, "You didn't take my course at Duke University, did you?" So, "Well, no, it was conflicting with something else. So I teach asset management, and this is a classic exam question." And for this student to call that 2% a year alpha, they would have failed my course. That's taking risk. So you're adding downside risk to the portfolio. You're clipping the positive tail of the S&P 500 return, and then you're adding to the negative tail. There's no alpha. That's zero alpha if you're doing this programmatically. If you're tactically writing the options, maybe that's different. Or if you find mispricings in the options, that's something different. But that's not what this person was doing, and that's just not alpha. Now, that said, if you're a long-term investor, maybe that's the sort of risk that you want to take, because you can ride out some of these negative events and you can collect the premia. So it's just not unusual to have some of these long-term investors doing things like Warren Buffett does, maybe not as explicitly, but they're definitely trading volatility, knowing that it's got the negative skew, and they are collecting the premia for that.
Yeah, exactly right. I think it's a skew strategy. It's one of those kind of classic, how do you maximize Sharpe ratio or information ratio for a strategy? And the answer is, you know, keep exactly what he was doing, kind of writing out of the call options. And in 9 out of 10 years, you look like a rock star. And in 10th year, you'd be bankrupt.
Then you just move on.
Yeah, so, well,
look,
exactly.
This is also like a basic misunderstanding. I've got these notes for writing a paper called "The 10 Biggest Mistakes That People Make in Finance," and one of them is to look at just the Sharpe ratios. So even like amongst hedge fund strategies, it's very interesting that there is a wide variation in Sharpe ratios. So some of these strategies have very high average Sharpe ratios through time, and some other hedge fund strategies have low. But why is it that all the money doesn't go to the high Sharpe ratio? And it's really simple. The high Sharpe ratio strategy is a strategy that has crash risk or negative tail, downside risk. Whereas the low Sharpe ratio strategy has got the opposite, like a time series momentum or trend following strategy. It's got positive skew. So that is something that people like. They want that in their portfolio. They want that protection. So they bid the price up, and the expected returns are lower, hence the lower Sharpe ratio. So people put way too much weight on Sharpe ratios. People, indeed, many don't even understand one fundamental concept in finance, and that's diversification. So the so-called only free lunch in finance. It's so basic, yet it's so misunderstood. Because often what we think about in diversification is purely based upon variance. So we get a portfolio that's optimized for some level of expected return to have the lowest possible variance. But that's not necessarily the optimal portfolio, because there could be many of those portfolios that have the same projected returns, that have the same volatility, but they've got different tails. And the investor always prefers the one with the positive tail over the one with the negative tail. So that's well established in kind of experimental literature, that people like the payoff of a lottery, and they're willing to pay for it. It's often just really poorly understood.
Completely. And I think I could probably open up another separate hour conversation on this whole notion of how the idea of horizon tacks onto this conversation as well. Obviously, we mentioned long-term investors, long-term holdings, but we're still talking the language of variance and volatility. And typically, these ideals, at least in practice of finance, are best or better, related or forecast over a sort of a sub 1 year type of category. A lot of the kind of serial correlation of volatility is used in a lot of risk modeling, for example. So when we really think about, I suppose, when you said you've got the same expected returns and you've got the same volatility, that could be true. Now, for a 5 or 10 year holding period, they can have very different trajectories or kind of interdependencies on various events or various other things that could happen in the future. So I think understanding what those look like as well in the future is a really interesting element of this. I'm really appreciative of your time, Cam, and I'm really conscious of the fact that we've got just a few minutes left really before we end here. And I was really hoping to kind of open up for a quick comment on the notion of machine learning. And it's clearly coming to the shores of finance. We see a lot of experimentation globally around using neural networks and various other methodologies, which are purely about data fitting. And there's a lot of very enthusiastic, albeit slightly naive, data scientists around the world who are kind of coming at this problem afresh, which is in some sense wonderful because it's a great time for reinvention and new ideas, but equally in a very kind of brutal way from our perspective, I guess, where they are coming at it straight into, can I forecast returns with lots of data and lots of models. I mean, given that we've identified that our industry is already a little bit perhaps guilty or kind of susceptible to model fitting over a lot of data, I mean, how is this new wave of technology or pressure going to impact us?
So I've written on this and it's very complicated. So data mining is not necessarily a bad thing. And indeed, in some scientific fields, it's the only thing. So if you're doing, let's say, genetic research, trying to find associations, you don't really have a good theory of the combination of genes that are associated with a particular disease. And you're essentially using these tools to give you some ideas. And then from those ideas, you potentially can build a model. So in other fields, data mining is a glorious activity that leads to the advance of science. In economics and finance, it's a completely different story. We have models in finance and economics, models from first principles. These models have had a significant impact, especially in capital markets. And that allows us to layer on something else in terms of our process of discovery. So there's a paper floating around that looks at 2.4 million different trading strategies based upon balance sheet information of companies and then kind of correlates that with the future stock returns. And the 10 best strategies found by the machine are striking. And the second best one, I'll tell you what it is. It's a measure of earnings per share divided by rental payments that the firm owes 4 years in the future. So it makes no sense. Why would you divide by the projected rental payments 4 years in the future? But that particular variable knocks the ball out of the park by whatever machine learning algorithm you're actually using. So what I'm saying is pretty simple. That variable, while it pops up in the top 10 for a machine learning algorithm, is something that nobody in their right mind would consider trading. It is a false factor and would be discarded. So the number one point is that we need to actually use the theory that we've got, and that guides us. And it might be that we can greatly sift through and reduce the dimensionality of the sort of factors that we're interested in. So that's number one. Number two, machine learning is complicated, and while there's plenty of, you know, libraries in Python and R, it's often the case that the company doesn't have the expertise. They get a summer intern that's doing like an 18-month master's program that's had one course and a few assignments that use some machine learning tool in R or Python. Then all of a sudden, that's the basis of the company's machine learning, that they apply the tool. There are hundreds of different machine learning algorithms out there. So different types of machine learning. So you need to know which type of machine learning approach best suits the particular problem. That's number one. And number two, you need to know how to do inference. So often what happens is, and I've seen this, and it's shocking, that people trying to explain 200 monthly returns with 200 variables, they do their validation and find something that works just amazingly well. And again, they could have it out of sample, but if you try enough things in sample and out of sample, something is going to work out of sample. And they're very poor at the inference. It looks great. The machine learning tool has delivered something really good in the back test. And again, let me emphasize, even with K-fold validation, this is possible. And then they take it to the client. The client puts money in, and it goes nowhere because these companies are not very good at inference. And indeed, this is kind of a bigger point here, that given the pace of technological change, given the advances in machine learning and quantitative methods, I believe that we'll see a shakeout in investment management. These small firms that have got the summer intern running their machine learning operation will be defeated by the larger firms that have been in this business for at least 5 years, that have amassed very interesting data, that have got PhDs in mathematics and machine learning, in statistics, that really know the correct ways to process these data with these tools, know the right ways to do the validation. Those are the firms that are going to win. So I believe the future in finance is much more quantitative than it is today. Look, even discretionary managers, they cannot deal with all of the data. In the past, they had a spreadsheet for a company. But now there's thousands of different databases. They need to use machine learning tools to help them provide information to inform their decision making. So we're moving much more in that direction, whether it's systematic or discretionary trading. Machine learning is here to stay. However, and this is important, there's a big spread in terms of the competence in actually applying it. So I've got a set of due diligence questions. Indeed, I published a paper on the sort of due diligence questions that you need to ask about the research process that goes on in the context of big data and machine learning. Right now, it's the Wild West, and people are playing the hype of machine learning. And again, this is something I believe in, but there's a lot of snake oil out there.
Wow. And on that powerful, powerful impact note, I can't help but feel like I'm not going to be reading a new revolutionary machine learning paper in Journal of Finance anytime soon. But I am really, I says positively, sort of encouraged by your statement that the future of finance holds more quantitative thinking and more quantitative approaches, if for no other reason than that competitive pressure that you mentioned and the data availability. But also, I'd love to see our industry become a lot more embracing of not only the 125 papers that you've written, but obviously the thousands of very valid and thoughtful papers that have been out there. And if hopefully this new age of more data kind of gets us closer to that, that'll be awesome, even if we have to go through some bumps along the way.
Yeah, I totally agree.
So thank you so much for your time today, Cam. Yeah, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Great. Thank you for having me on the show.